Hello there, everyone. Welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page, the Racing Post news, review, commentary, analysis programme. Loads to debate on the show again this week, and we would like you to be heavily involved as well, watching on YouTube. If you would like, comment, share and subscribe, we would be enormously grateful to you. Chris Cook, the Racing Post senior reporter, will no doubt have been like, commenting, subscribing and sharing left, right and centre.
Subscribing, definitely. Yeah, try and keep my comments to a minimum, you know, because you can't give too much away on social media, then people don't read you in the paper. You know, I've got to share, I've got to save the anger for the paper, you know.
Yes, wise, wise words. And a man who is never angry, always smiling, at his home in Cheltenham, is our West Country correspondent, James Stevens. Hello to you, James.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Lee, as well. I'm not sure about the angry line. I've certainly done that a few times myself, but no, looking forward to the show. Loads to get through, and some great race on the weekend to discuss as well.
And that will take us into our first story. We'll also be discussing, as we go through the programme, the findings of the Racing Post Racecourse Price Index series, which we revealed in the Big Read on Sunday, and the latest on affordability checks, and loads to report and bring you up to date on that one. But first of all, we are the Racing Post, and there was incredible racing over the weekend at Cheltenham, and some big, hard racing news stories as well. To lead on those, James Stevens.
Yeah, I mean, me and you were at Cheltenham on Saturday, Lee, and I think it was a day the jump season really sparked into life, wasn't it? It was billed as a really big day with all the sort of clashes. The Clarence House moved to the card, the Keith Hurdle had a really good lineup. You had the Gold Cup trial with Noble Yates there, who had wanted to go to Lingfield, or had wanted to run him at Lingfield, but that pulled off. So everything was set up for a huge day, and it delivered. You know, it doesn't often happen, but it did. So I suppose that the sort of story that came out of it is we now know a bit more about who might win in March, but we also know significantly less as well. So there were, the big sort of talking point, I suppose, is always the Gold Cup. And we had a Hoist in Your, a horse who, I suppose, at the start of the season was probably amongst the favourites, the favourite probably, for a British trained winner of a Gold Cup. And although his form had been a bit disappointing, he roared back to form with a really, really good win in the Cotswold Chase, stayed the trip really well, and looks like he's sort of made for a Gold Cup horse. A really sort of emotional day. Lucinda Russell's father sadly died in the week, and so it was a beautiful sort of moment for them to celebrate that and really pay tribute to him. The Grand National win, Noble Yates run well in third as well. We have the Clarence House Chase, which Edward Ageet scored a bit of a surprise in, 14-1, with Edward Stone second and Energome a bit disappointed in third. I'm sure we'll probably touch on their performances. And then a winner for France as well, with Gold Tweet winning the stairs, there's the Cleve Hurdle, and setting up a bid for the stairs hurdle as well. So, yeah, a really, really good day, and we know a bit more, but we know a bit less.
What do you feel you know more about, Chris? What did you learn on Saturday?
Well, I was really glad to learn that Hoist in Your is actually a credible Gold Cup contender. And, you know, the more
you think he is.
Yeah, the more my default position about Trials Day is that you can get a bit too carried away with it, a bit too excited. It wouldn't be any great surprise in reality if none of those winners sort of followed up at the festival.
Yeah.
And I have a particular concern about the Gold Cup trial, because you're talking about the end of January, it's only 6 weeks to go. I think it's pretty easy to leave behind your Gold Cup, if you get a really muddy day at Cheltenham at the end of January. But that's not how it was on Saturday. It was better ground than it would usually be for that fixture, a sort of mix of good to soft and soft, and the times weren't too bad. So, I think those staying chasers have got half a chance. I remember it looks like Trouble won both, didn't he? He went from the pillar chase, as it was then, to the Gold Cup. I just wish I knew what was going wrong with the Hoist in Your early in the season. I suppose he was a bit too fresh, maybe not jumping well enough in some cases. Kempton's not really made for him.
And Peter Scudamore was talking about that after the race. He said had a conversation with Lydia Hislop, who'd been sort of adamant that Kempton wasn't his track, and he agreed. he just feels now that that's just not his place. And I thought Lucinda was interesting too, saying that he's come of age. Today he's come of age. As if he's like a work in progress still.
Yeah, you can see that he is, he's, even now, he's still a work in progress. And maybe that goes with being such a big horse. I mean, there were points in that race on Saturday where he was running between fences and he was really looking like the Beau Ideal. You know, you would sort of just, if you could sort of freeze the frame, you'd say, pick the Gold Cup horse out of this field, it would be him. You know, he's a lovely, big, galloping, alert animal. But sometimes he gets to the fences and it all goes a bit Pete Tong. But there wasn't too much of that. I mean, he had a good look at the water jump, fiddled his way over one in the back straight, put down when he was asked for a big one at the last. But I mean, I think he was almost more clever than the jockey, really, because he maybe figured out he didn't need a big jump at the last. He was already on terms with Sounds Russian. Just put in a short one, get over the fence, and then he had enough engine to go away on the running. In a year where you don't have one standout contender for whom nothing's gone wrong, he's just not proved himself at the top level.
He still
hasn't done 3 miles, has he? Unless I missed it. This weekend will be interesting. I think the Gold Cup will be another test again for him. I mean, it will for all of them. I think he is a ridiculously short price, Galopin de Champs, given what he's proved already. But I mean, you know, people are understandably very wary of the Mullins hot pot, aren't they? I think all those horses are a little bit shorter than they would be, a lot shorter than they would be if they were in any other stable.
And I want to jump now to another Mullins hot pot. But before I do, I thought Noble Yates ran a big trial. I think with cheap pieces back on, the way he finished up the hill, I think he'd be a different horse.
Disappointing for those of us that actually backed him to win on Saturday.
He'll
get the headgear, obviously. I would worry that he, you know, in an ordinary Gold Cup where they go such a strong pace throughout, he's going to get outpaced again, even if he has got cheap pieces or maybe even blinkers on.
Potentially.
I think you're setting yourself up for another of those experiences where he's running on at the finish and you go, oh, Grand National horse. Who'd have thunk it?
I did like Robert Whaley Cohen's line after the race when it was put in the, you know, would you put cheap pieces on at Cheltenham? That's when they were meant to go back on. It's all about winning the Gold Cup and the Grand National. No point having ambitions if you're not going to work towards them.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a contender. He's got to be. He was given weight to the front too, wasn't he, on Saturday?
Yeah.
I can't ever remember a horse that won the Grand National and then turned into a Gold Cup horse. You know, you can sort of imagine it happening the other way around. We've always had horses that sort of like Hedge Hunter win a Grand National or Mon Mom as well, and they can run on into a distant third in the Gold Cup, you know, if it turns into a real slog. But that's not what he is. You know, he is a bit classier than that.
Yes. Chris referenced the Mullins Hot Pot there, James. We had another Mullins Hot Pot, of course, an even bigger Mullins Hot Pot on Saturday in the Clarence House Chase. An Ergomen completely blew out, really. Ballooned and skewed over the first fence, crashed through the final fence, and he was probably beaten at that point anyway. I thought going into the Clarence House Chase, the Champion Chase market was built around him. He was the defending champion. He was a red-hot favourite for that already. But now, when Alan King was saying after race, there's three in it now, obviously referring to Editor Dejeet, Edward Stone, who was a great second to Editor Dejeet on Saturday, and an Ergomen. But you can throw in Blue Lord, maybe Grenadine as well. All of a sudden, the Champion Chase looks completely wide open.
Yeah, absolutely. I think with an Ergomen, he was setting the standard, wasn't he? He was sort of the horse that was the previous winner, as you say, and had to win. I mean, you mentioned sort of his sort of early jumps. It's quite interesting speaking to William Owens after the race. He sort of said that the colour of the fences or the sort of paint, which had changed from orange to white, had sort of caught him by surprise and that the horse sort of wasn't aware, but that's something they're going to look to rectify. He did say that sort of at home they'd schooled him over sort of fences with a white trim. This was, of course, changed just for background, following a sort of study from Exeter University and with the BHA who commissioned it, which showed that horses' visibility was better with that sort of white trim. Either way, that's one of the things that William Mullins said, which is interesting. But yeah, you'd have to say he was fairly beaten and he needs to improve massively if he's going to turn the form around with the front two. It is open, but I was really impressed by the run of Edwardstone there. I thought that was a really, really good run. Alan King sort of said that he needed the run just to sort of get the edge off him. And yeah, you can expect him to continue to improve. He was a horse that thrived with his racing last year. He's a horse that will continue to get better as the season goes and is probably trained, like most of them, to peak in March. I thought he was a little bit unlucky not to win. Looked like he was coming there to win and just sort of got outbattled at the end. Maybe it will just be a case of him improving for the day, but I'd say if you were on Edwardson for the sort of champion chase, you would have been pretty happy with his performance on Saturday.
And Chris, would you be prepared to quickly forgive an Ergomen for that run? Because if you are, you can now get a decent price about him.
Yeah, I think I'd like to know what the ground is going to be if you're going to back him, because he probably needed a bit softer than you would usually get for. I mean, of course, it turned out ideal from last year. Mm-hmm. But looking at that race on Saturdays, I think it'd be pretty hard to back him the next time. Okay. Edwardson looks like he's the better horse, doesn't he? And I mean, the only reason he's got beat there is because they all gave Editor de Gite just a bit too much rope. I mean, and him in particular, Edwardson, he was held up a long way off him. If it comes up proper mud, then an Ergomen's the right favourite. But short of that, then it's got to be Edwardson, doesn't it? And then Blue Lord's got something like 7 lengths to make up on him from last year. He's clearly a better horse now than he was.
I think it's good, though, to see a race that had looked maybe straightforward, suddenly looking wide open. That's brilliant. What we want in the festival.
Actually, it's one of the things I always worry about is the number of odds on Favs we get at the festival these days. And we had one for that race.
We won't now.
And now we don't. Yeah. I think it's only, we're back down to only two for the whole of the festival now, Constitution Hill and Faso Vega.
Hurrah. Interesting story as well, thrown up at Sedgefield on Sunday. You've written loads about the whip. I know from reading pieces that you've written more about the whip than you wanted to write about the whip, but it's such a big story.
Yeah.
Sedgefield on Sunday, Sean Quinlan, very experienced jockey, was speaking in an interview with Andrew Thornton on Sky Sports Racing, and he spoke about his views about the revised whip rules that come into effect on Feb 13. He wasn't happy.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not so much his view about the rules as his experience of a sort of shadow implementation that we've had. Yeah. It's the bedding in period, isn't it? And the jockeys are trying to ride within the new rules, and the stewards are sort of thinking about how do we impose these new rules, and it's all a little bit experimental. He was told that over the last week he'd have racked up something like, was it 51 days,
51
he said,
days, he said,
in whip-related suspensions. I mean, an absolutely astonishing number to get to in a week's riding. Sean, he's very respected. You know, I still think he's an undersung jockey in terms of the effect that he can sometimes get. But he was clearly very worried. He's trying to comply with the new rules and still not quite able to make it work. He's been riding a certain way for 20 years. And it appears that under the new rules, he's going to have to adapt his style and do it differently. And the difficulty that he was discussing was he gets his whip action tends to be a little bit high. He hadn't realised quite high, but he's told that under the new rules, they're going to be dragging him in for the rule against having it above shoulder height. And the problem for him is that if he brings it lower in his action, then he's not necessarily going to be reaching all the way back to get the horse's hind quarters, and you're at risk of being brought in for breach of the other rule about hitting the horse in the incorrect place. So he was fretting about it, and he's obviously not the only one. And it strikes me that there's an awful lot of unintended consequences coming from this new draft of whip rules that we've got. It's very difficult to conduct any kind of experiment to see how they work in practice before it actually happens. That's why we've got the bedding in period. But I think it's clear that it's not going anything like as smoothly as people hoped. Not the jockeys and not the regulators either, because although the BHA, you know, they want to be strict, and they want to set new standards for use of the whip, I don't think they envisaged they'd be tripping up quite as many people as we've been getting over the first 2 or 3 weeks.
What will happen now then? What's your assessment? We've got, say, 2 weeks between now when these rules kick in. The BHA has already revised the rules following consultation with jockeys. The jockeys after that said, we're happy with these rules. Thanks for doing this now. Let's move forward. We know it's on us to make these rules work. If there are any more changes to the rules, it will almost look like the regulator is being regulated by the people it's supposed to regulate. Can you see any further changes kicking in before Feb 13? And if they don't, what happens?
Obviously, the BHA won't want to make any more changes for the reasons that you've outlined. But at the same time, it might be that everybody has to be a little bit pragmatic. I would say we've probably got another week of trying to make things work. And clearly, as far as I can see anyway, the jockeys are honestly trying to make it work. At the same time, they are also trying to get the best results out of horses sometimes on big occasions like Saturday, where you are still riding under the old rules. You know, although you're being encouraged to ride under the rules as they're going to be, you don't have to. You're not going to get penalised for breaching those, as long as you ride within the rules as they currently are. So you're in a little bit of a difficult situation. Owners and trainers will be putting pressure on you to get the right result now under the rules as they are. And at the same time, you're sort of trying to adapt with the future in mind and knowing that the Cheltenham Festival is just around the corner, where you can have both of those things, aren't you? Immense pressure, but also completely new rules. So, I mean, it's probably too early to quit on anything just now and to say, look, we can't make this work. It's a really difficult situation, and there is a certain amount of crisis talk again. I mean, I think when they went back on the forehand ban, jockeys were so relieved, and the PJA in particular were so relieved to have got rid of that, that I think the mood was really, let's just accept what we've been given now and try and make it happen, and it will be okay, because thank goodness we can still use the forehand. And it's turned out that the changes that are being contemplated are still really difficult, really exacting, and for some jockeys, you know, next to impossible to comply with so far. I mean, obviously not impossible, but it is. It's you can't underestimate how difficult it is to change a style that you've had for decades.
Well, I thought what was interesting though is a lot of this debate seems around the shoulder height rule, whereby.
And isn't that unexpected to you? It was like a non-factor a year ago.
But I also find it unexpected because, again, playing devil's advocate, the shoulder height rule was already there. Yes, it's been changed so that you go above shoulder height once, you're in trouble. Before it was twice, but it was still there.
Yeah.
So does that mean it just wasn't being policed?
Well, that is definitely part of the problem. It's got to be. So yes, you had to do it twice in a single race in order to be in breach of the rules, even as they are now. I totted it up. I think they had something like 9 breaches that were found in British racing in the first half of last year. And then twice as many in the second half of last year, because there's more of a focus on it, you know, now that we're talking about revised whip rules. And the monthly average has gone up again in January, even though we haven't changed the rules yet. So I think it must have been a case that the stewards were mostly focused on the number of times the jockeys were using the whip in the race. You know, that's number one. If you went above shoulder height, maybe they, most of the time, maybe they called you in and said, look, you know, we see you doing this, you can't keep on doing that, you know, we'll use our discretion on this occasion, but word to the wise, you know, keep it below shoulder height in the future. There must have been a lot of that going on. Now the stewards have been told they've got no discretion, they've got to apply these rules as they are written. And this is the consequence, you know. When there's no give at all in these rules, suddenly the shoulder height thing is really a live issue. And I certainly don't think the jockeys saw that coming. I don't really think the BHA thought it would be as much of an issue as it's turning out to be.
No, and I think it's going to be a big, big issue, isn't it, over the next 2 weeks. And then when we get to February 13, when this all kicks off, well, let's hope it doesn't kick off, but it might. Second story this week, then, is linked to the big read I penned for the Racing Post in Sunday's newspaper. Since May last year, our reporters have been, when visiting racecourses in Britain and Ireland, working on a series called the Racecourse Price Index, where we tried to gauge what the cost of racing, a day at the races, is for people, particularly in these difficult times with the cost of living crisis. Everybody has got less money in their pockets to sell. Most people have got less money to spend in their pockets on discretionary items, on things that aren't absolute essentials. Horse racing is not an essential. We've been noticing how much it costs to get into the race course, for a pint of Guinness, for a bottle of water, for a burger, for a bit of food. And we've collated all that data, and on Sunday we presented it in a 4-page big read. Number of findings you can see in the piece if you go and read it. I thought one of the most obvious ones for me was that, in general terms, this perhaps isn't the biggest surprise in the world, but it was quite stark with the numbers, it's much cheaper to go horse racing in Ireland. And that is across all levels. If you're going to a festival day in Ireland, you might be off to Leopardstown this weekend for the Dublin Racing Festival, you will find that is much cheaper than the Cheltenham Festival or the Grand National Festival. You'll find the same if you're going to Punchestown at the end of the season. But even at the more day-to-day level, it is cheaper to go racing in Ireland than in Britain, with obviously sometimes the entry level pegged at the same sort of amount, around €15 for a day at the races in Ireland. We talked about the price of food and beverages in the piece as well, and it was noted that obviously you're paying £7.50 for a pint of Guinness at Cheltenham. You were paying £3 a bottle of water at Chest, although they reduced that price to £2 after the RPI piece ran there during the summer, which seems a lot, but Racecourse in the piece explained why they charge the prices that they do. They talked about how if you are a pub or a restaurant, you're open all year round and your overheads are much less and you're only opening a food and drink facility for maybe 15, 20 days a year. I thought that was interesting as well in the piece. And I thought also interesting was Conor O'Neill, the main man at Punchestown Supremo there, talking about how he acknowledged that for a lot of race days, it actually would be more cost effective for race courses to say racing without anybody there, because the infrastructure you have to put in place, if you have 500 people or 5,000 people, it's largely the same. But he doesn't want to go down that line of having racing without spectators, because spectators are absolutely vital for the sport to succeed now and in the future. We are an entertainment industry and it has to be treated as such. Chris, what did you take from the whole RPI series?
Yeah, I'm quite struck by this graph that turned up in Sunday's paper there, where it says the average race meeting, the price of admission is £21.55, and it has a little bar chart comparing it with all sorts of other options, including a Saturday matinee at Les Mis.
£72. That was the cheapest ticket.
Yikes. That's the cheapest ticket, is it? I see. That's quite an eye-opener for someone like me who wouldn't often be showing up for Saturday matinees in the Big Smoke.
And I think that's a key point. That top level, if you look at the major racing festivals and you compare them to other sporting events, I was noticing that if you wanted to go, say, to the Saturday qualifying at Silverstone for the British Grand Prix this year, £179.
So, I mean, Formula One fans would say that's effectively a once-in-a-year opportunity, isn't
potentially.
It?
Potentially. And you might say something about a day at Wimbledon. But if you want to go to Centre Court, you're going to pay £80 to £255. You mentioned Les Mis there, so Saturday matinee this weekend, £72.50 for the cheapest ticket. And I go to theatre a lot, and I know that not that long ago, 60, 70, 80 quid would have got you one of the front seats in the stalls for a major West End show. Now you're going to be at the back of the stalls or maybe in one of the circles high above. So that's really soared ticket prices. Not been quite the same in horse racing.
Yeah, I mean, we've often said in the past, haven't we, that you know your average day's racing is really good value compared to other sports. And the data that we've presented in Sunday's paper appears to me to bear that out. I mean, we're comparing ourselves to Colchester Gillingham, and we're slightly cheaper for the average race meeting. You mentioned there the number of sort of food and drink outlets that are on offer at some of these meetings, and I think that is a bit of an issue. It may just be me, but I sense some tracks over the years have got more and more sort of hawkish about closing those down on quiet days. And they're really not offering a great deal for your actual spectator to turn up. And I suspect that they've cottoned on, haven't they? That they make more money when they don't have to fuss about the flaming crowd. You know, if you're going to have people on the site, then that costs you money in terms of the sort of security provision and the food and drink that you may not be sure how many takers you're going to get for those things. It's hard work for an atmosphere to create an atmosphere on a slow day at the races. And that takes investment from racecourses. And I hope there's still enough will there from the racecourses to make that investment and to come up with the imagination and the energy to create that atmosphere that will bring people to the tracks, you know, over and over again. It would be very easy, I think, for some tracks to just take the media rights money. Yeah. And sort of effectively close the doors. I mean, not actually close the doors, but, you know, deter people from coming by not actually offering a great deal on the site. That's a worrying thing. You know, for the long-term good of the sport, you need to keep that connection with actual people coming through the gates, I think. You know, you need to keep that connection with your local community. But, you know, if you were looking to market the sport, I think there's certainly some evidence in this series. Which can be projected as good news. You know, we're affordable and it's a whole afternoon's entertainment. And, you know, it doesn't have to be about the betting, but, you know, hopefully you don't get turned away for a bet if that is what you're interested in when you come to the races.
James, you were at Cheltenham as well as I was on Saturday. They had a really good crowd there, very impressive total attendance. The Festival Trials Day, people having a good time there at the track. Do you think that was reflective of the race-going experience in Britain and Ireland?
I would say that the crowd there was more reflective of how quality the racing was itself. You know, good horses, good racing, competitive racing is going to make people on the go, you know, and I'm sure people from all over the country would have come to Cheltenham because the racing was so good, you know, big racing fans. Yeah, this was interesting. I've done my own bits of RPI across the southwest in Wales and such. I've had some very bad burgers, to be honest with you, so. yeah, unfortunately so. I mean, there's a few things that I would sort of raise. I know we've talked about, there's always the rumour in the press room, isn't there, that some tracks are looking at going behind closed doors because it would just be cheaper. And I know that at Foss Lass, where I did one of the series in January, they talked about sort of how they have almost, they call it sort of different tiers of how busy a race there is. And tier three was essentially one place for food, one real bar open, and the choice was really limited. But it was because they knew that the crowd wasn't going to be good, so they can open it up and no one's going to come. So that's kind of interesting as a sort of way that racecourses may look and change and adjust to obviously the prices of things and how much it costs and how much it costs them to run a race day. So that's sort of interesting, but I still think it is almost waving the white flag a bit. You know, the fact that these racecourses are saying, well, we're not going to open it because we can't attract them. So this would probably lead me on to another of the week's stories, which was about the findings of the results almost of way of looking at Great British Racing's marketing campaign in the summer, which was sort of starred with Jermaine Genas, former footballer. Does the one show, did the World Cup draw for some bizarre reason as well. But a major sort of name, and he's well known. And unfortunately, the sort of success of this campaign hasn't been as good as I imagine they wanted it to. 1.6 million, there's a sort of funding behind it, and the senses have been down. So there's, I mean, my way of thinking is yes, of course, we need to make racing more affordable. And I think that this evidence proves that racing is, to a certain extent, affordable. There's always different ways you can make it more affordable. There's different incentives you can have to drag people. And I think that the evidence of the way this campaign just hasn't worked and it's not really had much of an impact. I mean, just to get some data, just to sort of show you, I mean, Jermaine Genas probably would have cost quite a lot of money to get him behind this advertising campaign. He's on his social media. I found one image of him on Instagram at Chris Goodwood. Other than that, I've seen nothing apart from tweeting out the same bog standard tweet, which was going around with this image, with this video of the campaign. So whether that was value for money or not, time will tell. But in my opinion, probably not. Racecourses need to make days exciting. They need to make people want to come. You go in your emails in the morning, there'll be hundreds of sales offers, bargains. This is what we can offer you. The competition is absolutely massive at the minute. People are desperate to make you choose to spend their money with them, regardless of what it is. Racing cannot just sit there and say, the day at the races is good. It has to drag people and it has to bring something. And when the racing is quality, as it was on Saturday, people will come. But it's not always going to be like that. You need to be clever. You need to market it well. And unfortunately, I don't think racecourses do that enough. So that's the big problem for me. But yeah, I'm glad I'm not having any more dodgy burgers at racecourses. Some of them are good, but probably hasn't been some fairly bland ones.
Cornish pasty was nice at Cheltenham on Saturday.
Excellent. To be fair. Yeah. Glad to hear that. I've tell you what, I've really had a bad burger myself. I'm obviously less fussy than James. Maybe they should send me on these missions.
Well, you signed up now. Marketing, the problem for marketing and racing, it strikes me, having done a piece slightly about the popularity of this sport, and again spoken to Rod Street from GBR, is that we just haven't got the money that other sports have got to market horse racing. He was comparing how much British racing's marketing pot is to Irish racing's marketing pot, and it's nowhere near as big. And if you stroll through Paris, or you go through a metro station, anywhere near the time of the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe or the Grand Steeplechase de Paris, you will see lavish marketing for those races. If you're involved in marketing British racing, you must look at those two jurisdictions and other sports and think, if only.
Well, I mean, that's related to the funding, isn't it? I mean, for for various reasons, the sport in Ireland and in France is just better funded than we are in Britain. And that's just something we've got to put up with. So we have to be clever, isn't it? And agile, that's the word they use in marketing, I'm sure. There are lots of good stories that we can tell if we're determined to get people back racing.
Including the story that was on BBC News the end of last week, which again was through GBR, I think, of Billy Lochney.
Yeah.
His story was told on the 6 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news by Laura Scott. Really good, positive story that got out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's loads more like that. I mean, I wrote last week about how we seem to have got trapped in a cycle of telling nothing but bad news stories. But then maybe that's because there's just so many bad news stories around just now, including tracks needing to make back the money that they lost in COVID times. But maybe we can make more use of the wider media, the non-racing media, who don't seem to hear from us very often. We need to be pushing more in that direction.
Yeah.
It's a constant struggle, and of course you're still fighting on those battlegrounds with other sports that want exposure too.
And one bit of good news before we move on.
Can I just jump in here?
Yeah, of course you can.
Obviously, the money you said that we have isn't as much as other sports, and I accept that, and that's obviously true, but 1.6 million is quite a lot of money, you know, and there's different ways of doing it. I mean, one of the key things that I think I keep sort of going back to is the comments from one of the industry meetings where the big concern was that people's of between 18 and 25, they sort of aren't betting on horse racing. Their money is being spent to gamble on football. And so the appeal of the sport with them, the future of the sport, and obviously if they gamble on it, they're probably interested in it and they're obviously funding the sport. There is so much opportunity for racing to really tap into that market. Things like TikTok, which the Jockey Club do fantastic jobs with, and Racing TV have a bit of a service for that. There's different ways to do it. And I sort of accept that we don't have the money, but I think that this campaign really would have to question whether the marketing is being sold right, because I just don't think they quite understand the audience and how to get a new audience into racing. Of course, we want diversity, that's what it was about, and sort of promoting the fact that racing's for everyone, that's fantastic, it's a great message to come across, but I think that as much as they don't have funding, this was funding spent incorrectly.
Strong point there from James. Just to end on a positive note before we move on to the final story, one thing that did emerge to me just working on this piece was that there are maybe offers available that we don't all realise that. I was told about the Go Racing in Yorkshire season ticket. If you pay £420, which is a lot of money, if you pay £420, you get access to every single Yorkshire meeting in the calendar, including the Ebor Festival and the Ledger Festival. So if you're a race goer in Yorkshire, that's a heck of an offer.
That is an absolute ton of racing, isn't it?
You know, you sign up to an ARC membership for an ARC track, and you also get you get attendance at every single ARC fixture.
Yeah.
So you're a member at Southwell, but you can go to every Donny fixture. You sign up to a Jockey Club membership, you get tons of reciprocal days. So if you're a very keen race goer, there are loads of options there for you. You've got the cash to lay out for that one of those memberships.
I mean, there's got to be scope, hasn't there, for like some sort of centralised website pointing people towards all of these deals? I don't think that's done. You know, there's no centralised place I can think of that you could go to find out about all that stuff. Yeah. Maybe that's there's scope there for some website, one of those market disruptors, to just sort of, if you subscribe to it, then they send you in the right direction to save your money on horse racing. The Yorkshire one sounds like a great deal, but I mean, that's obviously pointed at retirees, I would think. You know, you would need to have a lot of spare time, free time during the week to take advantage of that. But I mean, you could get a huge amount of racing in quite a short time if you're getting to every Yorkshire race meeting.
Because part of the problems is these days is you might want to go racing, but you might not be able to bet on the races.
Yeah.
Because of affordability checks. I know we discuss this a lot on the programme, but it's hugely important, and things keep happening, and a lot happened last week.
It felt like a bit of a watershed moment, because the thing we've been complaining about is, you know, this white paper never turns up, and so we don't really know what the government thinks. And, you know, is the Gambling Commission right to act in the way that it has been doing? You know, does it have the government's backing in sort of pushing bookmakers to make these checks, affordability checks, source of funds checks, on so many customers, such a large proportion of their customers that they have been doing? So in Friday's paper, we carried the news that the British Gambling Minister, Paul Scully, has basically come out and said that, you know, that this isn't supported by the government. I'll get the quotes because they were very strong.
Yeah, they were strong.
He was addressing a meeting of the Betting and Gambling Commission Council. He said, let me be really clear here that it is not the role of the government, it is not the role of the Gambling Commission to tell people how much of their salary they are, quotes, allowed to spend on gambling. That's just not our role. And there was more in that vein about, you know, what checks that are going to be, ought to be frictionless. It seems to me like this is a really serious moment, and you would like to hear from the Gambling Commission in response.
Wouldn't you?
But they continue to be very quiet, and it strikes me a little bit like I sometimes complain about the BHA. When they go quiet like that, it has the effect anyway of shielding them from scrutiny. I mean, you know, one assumes that that's not why they're doing it, but they should be talking about this, shouldn't they? They should be explaining their actions. They should be explaining why we're in a situation where so many regular and long-standing punters and gamblers, people who've been betting within their means for a very long time, are now being put off from betting at all, or being made to jump through these really sort of onerous hoops, having to provide financial documentation that you'd much rather not share with anybody, never mind a bookmaker.
And that's betting shop punters too, as Peter Scargill revealed in
an amazing story in today's paper, amazing to me. I've obviously not been spending enough time in betting shops. I mean, that would always be true. You should always spend time around a betting shop. It's just fun. People are actually, when they're turning up in their shops where they've been betting for a long time, there was a lady who's written a letter to us today saying she was presented with a letter at Betfred, I think it was, saying, you know, dear customer, you need to give us this, this, and this, otherwise you won't be able to carry on betting here. Here, I'll quote from her letter. She says, the letter said, I was not allowed to gamble in any Betfred shop in the UK until I provided photo identification, namely a passport or driving license. Unfortunately, I never had a driving license and my passport expired 20 years ago. In addition to this, the company wanted 3 months worth of bank statement. I mean, what just an absolutely astonishing situation.
Disgraceful.
The idea that you would turn up in any shop and they would ask you for that kind of stuff. I mean, instinctively, you think you would just turn on your heel and march out, you know, in high dudgeon. But this is the reality, you know, if you don't produce this documentation when it's requested, then you don't get to bet. Not just in that shop, but in any other shop belonging to the chain. And this lady, I forget her name, you know, she's having to hop on the bus to get to the next town so that she can bet in some other shop there. And it just shows the dedication that she's got to betting on the horses occasionally. Because she doesn't have a driving license, she's told us, she's having to make that effort. You know, and maybe that would be quite good discipline. I know that I would think about my bets a lot more carefully if I was having to bus it to the next town in order to get a fiver on.
The crazy, crazy, crazy thing now is that we've got punters being treated like that by bookmakers who are in fear of a regulator whose policy the government has said last week shouldn't be a policy.
Yes.
And yet it's still going to be going on, and it could go on for a considerably long period.
Well,
if they do nothing.
We're promised the white paper is coming in a matter of weeks. But that has also been true for at least 14 months, I can remember. I mean, this is the incredible white paper that never appears.
Well, obviously, but also a white paper is only proposed legislation.
Sure.
The Gambling Commission might say, let's wait till this becomes an act of parliament if the government doesn't stipulate what it needs to do. And James, the point I made in the column as well today is that This affordability check misery that a lot of punters are experiencing could be heightened over the coming weeks, because we're entering that countdown to the Cheltenham Festival period, where I know I bet a lot more around Cheltenham Festival time than I would do for the rest of the year. My punting is not like a gym membership where I pay the same every month, the same amount goes out of my bank account every month. I'll spend a lot more over the coming weeks. And I also might want to use a non-runner no bet facility. I referenced Gaelic Warrior in the column today. If you want to back him for the Coral Cup, the County Hurdle and the Martin Pipe, because you can't read Willie Mullins' mind and you're not quite sure which race Willie would like to run that horse in at the festival if he goes down the handicap route, then if you back him for all those three races and perhaps a Ballymore as well, every one of those bets counts towards your turnover total, which counts towards the point at which an affordability check threshold would kick in from a bookmaker algorithm, and all of a sudden you're having to produce bank statements, P60s and pay slips. It's that's going to be a big concern, isn't it, for punters and bookmakers over the coming weeks?
Absolutely, Lee. Yeah, and you make some really, really good points there. I think sort of from a Cheltenham Festival perspective, yes, it's obviously a huge sort of event for a lot of people who will have a bet. And for a lot of people, I imagine this will be the first time they may have accounts that they only really use at the Grand National and the Cheltenham Festival and odd days when they may go racing once a season. So this may be for a lot of people their first experience of affordability checks, especially if they are sort of people who are going to be betting a certain amount that's sort of there. And for them, it's just going to be a complete turn off, isn't it? It's just going to be, oh my God, what's happening here? And as you say, you're right. If you go into a shop and ask that, it's like a different world, isn't it? You sort of read that story and just like, really? It's just unbelievable that this is happening. I mean, in terms of where I am with this sort of story, I think what we heard this week was extremely encouraging. I think that this story is going to be really quite interesting how it's perceived in sort of national press, because obviously there has sort of been, we were talking about Martin Lewis, weren't we, at Cheltenham on Saturday, about sort of his comments about gambling advertising, and I think people's sort of association with gambling, and I saw he did a poll where he said what's everyone's sort of opinion on gambling advertising, and the overwhelming majority was I don't bet and I don't want gambling advertising. So I know these things are very different, but this story is going to be really, really interesting to see where the public sit with it, but also where people who have more of a casual gambling relationship, whether that's going to be a massive turn off, because their draw and their influence is why those Cheltenham Festival races are so the turnover is so high in those Cheltenham Festival races. It's all those hundreds and thousands, possibly even millions of people that turn on racing for the Cheltenham Festival. If racing doesn't do enough to, or if affordability checks even, turn them away, then the sports funding is in severe trouble.
I mean, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that one or two newspapers have helped to contribute to a sort of anti-gambling atmosphere that's taken over the last few years.
At both ends of the newspaper spectrum too, Daily Mail and The Guardian. How often do they agree on something?
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, betting is a habit that I've had. No, I wouldn't say habit, because it's a choice. I don't feel like it's something that I do out of any kind of thoughtless compulsion.
No, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, exactly. And it's been a source of great pleasure since I was old enough to do it, and maybe even a bit before, actually. I can't remember a time when the general mood was so suspicious of betting. I mean, it's always been a slightly louche thing to engage in, and there's always been people who sort of raise their eyebrows at the idea that you might indulge in it, and they always think that you're getting ripped off and you're bound to lose in the long run. I've always maintained that, you know, if you're betting on horses, then you're sort of applying knowledge and skill and judgment, and it's not like playing roulette. You know, you're not a certainty to lose in the long run. You can hope to win, and it's obviously the hope that kills you. But I mean, these days, obviously, if you put it to a referendum, you know, betting might even be closed down, because, you know, most people don't engage in it. And therefore, they don't really care, and they don't think about, you know, what it might contribute to somebody's life, and they don't take on the fact that, you know, unfortunately, although there are people who suffer by it, they're very much at the margins, and most people can sort of engage in a healthy sort of relationship with betting and get plenty out of it without suffering. Unfortunately, we're at risk by being in the minority, as it were. But hopefully, there's also an understanding out there in the sort of the wider population that. You're not supposed to, as a government, you're not supposed to regulate for the sake of it. You know, and it's very surprising to me that we've got a Tory government that's sort of even been brushing up against the idea of pinning down what you can do with your money and restricting you in new ways. And perhaps this intervention by Paul Scully last week will be like a turning of the tide, and we'll start to see some pushback now on this idea that gambling is something to be curbed and restricted and closed down. Because that has felt to me like the tenor of the conversation over the last few years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there were reports in the press over the weekend that the BBC's Today programme is considering axing its racing tips.
That's been talked about in the past for a few years.
But again, if that's linked purely to an editorial position, they feel, you know,
what's a load of nonsense?
Well, really? Absolutely. But if it's done for a moral position, that just seems crazy.
So it's just very easy, isn't it, for people, and I think this is something that young people are especially guilty of, to take what they imagine is a moral position without examining the truth of the situation in any depth. And they go, oh, gambling, that's, you know, that's a tax on innumeracy and optimism. Or it's a tax on people who should be saving their money and can't afford to be losing. You know, and they don't consider that actually some people might get a great deal of pleasure out of it, that it might be a life-enhancing thing for a lot of people, in fact. Yeah, I think what we're our problem here is that we're in danger of getting regulated by people who have no idea what they're talking about. But hopefully we can make it clear that that's not warranted and and not desirable.
Certainly not desirable to be regulated by an unelected quango either, particularly the elected government. I said it has a different position to that quango. Three stories then wrapped up in this week's bumper edition of the front page. James Stevens in Cheltenham, talking about Cheltenham on Saturday and the wider issues that sprang up over the weekend. James, really good story there. And in a normal week, you might perhaps have won. In a normal week, perhaps I might have won, because I thought the Racecourse Price Index revealed many fascinating things. But Chris Cook, I think that development on the affordability check story last week, that potentially seismic development, hopefully seismic development, I think means that you should be this week's winner of the front page.
I was just lucky enough to be on the right horse this time, Lee.
Well, you did it beautifully. Chris Cook is the winner of this week's show. Thanks to Chris. Thanks to James Stevens in Cheltenham. Before I go, I have some housekeeping notices to alert you to. Racing Post Members Club offer here. Get your first month for free. Use the link in the video to find out more. It's a fantastic dinner members club. All the best Racing Posts, talent, tipsters, writers, all sorts on there. Well worth subscribing. And also well worth using the Racing Post app. We suggest that you download our new app. Great content from those aforementioned biggest names. Tipping, writing, features, news, cards, form, all sorts on the Racing Post app. And with that news, I wish you an excellent week. If you are heading off to the Dublin Racing Festival, to Sandown, or wherever, have a great time in the races this week. And we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.